the Big Blue Kickoff live right here on Giants.com, joined by Lance Meadow. I am John Schmelk, 201-939-4513. Hashtag Giants chat on Twitter if you want to join us that way. Lance, how was your weekend?
Can't complain. A lot of football. Sunday was quite busy with the conference championship games. How were things with you?
Everything's all right. The conference championship games, obviously, I think more of a blowout than most people would have liked. I know you and Paul touched on them a lot yesterday. But we'll have to talk about next week. But a fun Super Bowl, I think, upcoming between the Patriots and the Falcons. And I think how Bill Belichick is going to game plan against that very variable Falcons offense should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, you've got the number one offense against the number one defense, so I don't think you could complain from that perspective.
Don't forget, by the way, Patriots number two scoring offense as well.
True. That's a good point by you. I think a lot of people overlooked that because of, believe it or not, how effective the defense has been this season. I actually think that that had been an overlooked facet, but you're right. The offense is not too shabby, and, you know, Deion Lewis 1 week, Chris Hogan the next week. Who knows who's going to be the star in the Super Bowl?
And, you know, I made the point on Twitter over the weekend that I was surprised watching the pregame shows on Sunday morning. I thought 75% of the experts picked the Steelers in that game.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't notice that.
I was really surprised how many people were picking Pittsburgh. I thought the Falcon Packer game was kind of split 50-50.
Which makes
maybe
sense.
Maybe sliding a little bit towards Atlanta, which I understand. But I thought there were certainly more Steeler picks than Patriot picks. And everyone kept saying, you know, Roethlisberger, Bell, Brown, and I think people look at the Patriot offense and they're like, these guys don't impress me, but they get the job done because of Brady, because of the system and the way they work their offense. So I think people have to be a little bit careful not dismissing the Patriot offense because of the lack of names outside of Brady. And the same way, I think you also have to be careful not dismissing the Falcons defense, who doesn't have a lot of names that people recognize.
Vic Beasley, Dwight Freeney, they have an improved pass rush. They're secondary up and down, but you're right. Falcons were very effective in getting to Aaron Rodgers and flustering them throughout the conference championship game. I think it is easy to overlook the New England offense, but I'm very surprised that people overlooked the Steelers' defensive struggles against Tom Brady.
Absolutely.
Now, John, you can argue personnel has changed over the tenure of Mike Tomlin as head coach and who Brady has seen on the opposite end. I get that. So I'm not one to say, oh, well, what happened 5 years ago is going to happen again. Listen, we talked about that with the Giants and the Packers, and I was telling everybody, despite what history has shown and the Giants have had the Packers' numbers, you can't assume it's going to translate to this season. So putting that aside here for a second, Pittsburgh's always had a zone defense. That has not changed. And Tom Brady is a magician against his own defense. He struggles more against man-to-man. So he has 19 touchdowns, no interceptions, coming in 6 games against Mike Tomlin as a head coach. But most important, their defensive coordinator, who is Dick LeBeau and now Keith Butler. And the fact that they went back to that zone defense and stuck with it and didn't really mix and match, I can't say I'm very surprised.
Well, here's the thing. You can play zone defense, but you have to mix up the types of zones.
Of
you have to mix up pressures. You can't just run the same thing out against Tom Brady. And look, quite frankly, people can say, oh, you can't play zone every time. You can if you play it well. I have never seen so many guys and open receivers without a defender within 10 yards of them when they catch the football.
Chris Hogan.
In any game I'm watching all year. And you're right, I think going into that game, people underestimated the struggles that the Steelers' defense has had this year. And I think people probably overestimated how much they had improved based on the opponents they faced.
And they did play well down the stretch.
They played, but look at their opponents, though. The Chiefs, good offense, not great. They gave up 24 points to the Cleveland Browns. I know that was a game that didn't really matter last week
of the year. A lot of the starters were benched, too. I don't know how
much
you put in that.
They gave up 27 points to the Ravens on Christmas. The Ravens aren't exactly a big-time offensive team. The Bengals, who had all sorts of injuries and issues this year, put up 20 against them. The Bills put 20 up on them. You go back, and this is the game that I always think of, because that's really the last time the Steelers played a great offense. On Thanksgiving, the Cowboys marched the ball on them at will. Up and down the field, running the ball, throwing the ball. It didn't matter. The Cowboys did whatever they wanted against Pittsburgh in that game. So I was concerned with their ability to stop New England, and I think that kind of bore out a little bit.
Yeah, well, the Steelers have struggled in stopping the run throughout the course of the season. We've seen that. And New England, I thought, you know, between LeGarrette Blount and some of their other weapons, had some success. And, you know, their secondary, John, has been a question mark going back to last season.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they were very up and down
and
in terms of their coverage guys. Yes, a lot of young guys.
And they'll get better.
Absolutely, but between the working in progress of the secondary and what the pass rush provides, you know, they've had some injuries in the front seven. I can't say that I'm very surprised in terms of New England's success. It's just a matter of also, you know, Pittsburgh needing to do more offensively, too. I think we focus a lot about their failures on defense, but let's not forget, you're in the red zone. You're on the inch mark after Jesse James, their tight end, goes down.
First down.
3 points? No.
And look, Le'Veon Bell's absence, obviously a factor.
But
no
still.
One's going to argue that. But you're right. And look, you saw the week before in the red zone against the Chiefs, they couldn't get the ball into
six
the end
field
zone.
Goals.
So, things to look at in terms of the other playoff game real quickly, the Falcons and Packers. That was the Packer team I thought that was going to show up either week one against the Giants in the playoffs or week two against Dallas in the playoffs. It was only a matter of time. You knew the defense was bad, all right? The Giants did not take advantage of that when they should have in the first half, and then the second half, look, you have to do better against that Packer defense. Bottom line, period, there's no other excuse for it. Dallas started a little bit slow due to self-inflicted wounds. Once they got to the second quarter, they marched the ball left and right. I don't think they punted in the final in the second half of that game against Green Bay. But the offense for the Packers was so efficient, didn't make any mistakes, and Aaron Rodgers made so many spectacular plays that it made up for all those deficiencies. What happened this past weekend? Drop passes, fumbles.
Mental mistakes.
And then the defense had interceptions in their hands. They couldn't make it. They had fumbles on the ground in their arms. They couldn't hold on
Jake
to the
Ryan,
ball.
Jake Ryan, the linebacker.
So you had different things add up where the Packers simply are not as talented as the Falcons. They weren't as talented as Dallas the week before, but they outplayed those teams. This was a week where they got outplayed by the Falcons, and the Falcons were more talented. So that's why they got blown out. And I thought that was going to happen to the Packers. And that's a credit to them for playing so shorthanded and winning so many games in a row since the middle of the year when Rodgers said they would run the table. Great job out of Green Bay. But with their injuries and their talent level, because of, in large part because of those injuries, this day was going to come. It just all happened to come at once, and that's how you lose by 30 points.
Well, I said this, and I think I even put it out on Twitter. To me, that game was a microcosm of the Packers' season because they also lost a lot of guys, if you recall, during the course of the game. Micah Hyde, their defensive back. They lost three starting offensive linemen. You know, you brought up the point that they had been opportunistic, and when you're an injury-plagued defense and you don't have a lot of your playmakers, how do you make up for that? How do you cover all that up? Well, you get turnovers. You change field position. What did they not do against Atlanta? They did not have takeaways. So, you know, that hurt them. Like you said, Aaron Rodgers relied on his receivers making plays. That did not take place on Sunday. And, you know, all of it bottled up, and that's a big reason why they're not moving on.
And just to go full circle to the Giants here real quick, you got to score in the postseason to win. And look at how many of these playoff teams have won their games scoring fewer than 20 points. Hasn't really happened. So you're going to have to score more points. The Giants, six straight games to close out the season without scoring 20. That has to change next year if the Giants want to make a deep playoff run, period. No debate about it.
Well, New England, high 30s, Atlanta over 40. Yeah, those are the types of teams that are representing their respective conferences in the Super Bowl. You're absolutely right. You can't rely on winning low-scoring affairs in the postseason. Yes, the defenses dramatically improve in the postseason, John. Mm-hmm. But it's the prolific offenses, based on what we've seen in this postseason, they're the ones that are advancing and competing for a championship.
Well, you need balance. You look at these teams, and it's the teams that are good on both sides of the ball, the ones that have moved on. The one-dimensional teams, look at the Cowboys, how they lost to the Packers last week. The Packers finally got their comeuppance this week against Atlanta. Those are the teams that have dropped off rather quickly. Thanks for joining us on Twitter, everybody. We appreciate it. We're now going to be joined by Paul Schwartz of the New York Post. If you want to continue to listen and check out that interview, please do so on Giants.com. or on the Giants mobile app. Paul, you got Lance Beno and John Schmelk here in beautiful East Rutherford, New Jersey. How are you today? How are you enjoying your vacay, or are you on your way to the Super Bowl right now, or will you be shortly?
Well, I got back from Atlanta happily yesterday because the weather were issues, and got back with a little turbulence, I would say, on the way down, but nothing crazy. And right now I'm contemplating whether I need to build an ark. out on Long Island, it is raining quite heavily right now in the very saturated ground. So, Houston will be in 6 days. I'll be leaving Monday for a fun-filled week in Houston.
Well, if you work fast, you could take that arc down to Houston if you want. What lessons, Paul, have you taken from these 2 weeks of postseason that you can apply to the Giants their season that just passed and why they came up short, or even lessons in terms of what the Giants can take moving forward to where they need to improve their team if they want to make a deeper run in 2017.
Wait a second. Could you take an ARC to Houston?
Yeah. It'd
be an eventful trip.
It's a long way around, sure, but you can, I think.
I guess. It would be quite the navigational way to get to Houston, I think. But
all right.
So what was that question? Something about the Giants? What was that?
Yeah. What lessons did you take from the playoffs that either maybe explain to you why the Giants didn't make a run?
Yeah. Score more points. It's not that tough. Score more points. The Giants were operating on a ridiculously thin margin, you know, scoring between 15 and 19, 20 points a game is not going to win in the playoffs. It was easy to spot. I mean, my goodness, the Packers scored 21 and got destroyed. You need to score points. The Patriots won big with a lot of points. You know, the week before, the Falcons, you know, scored 36 on the Seattle. So the lesson is, the Giants had a defense that could still be playing. They had an offense that was very fortunate to be carried by their defense into the playoffs. And, you know, much as at this point exactly 1 year ago, you know, Jerry Reese was tasked with, you know, fixing a terrible defense. Jerry Reese this year has to fix not a terrible offense, but an offense definitely in need of repair.
Well, and that basically brings me to my next question, Paul, because I think since you were down in Atlanta, you could use the Falcons as an example. Atlanta a year ago at this time was probably looking at its roster and saying, we've got offensive line issues and we have defensive line issues. We have issues in the trenches. So what do? They go out, they get Alex Mack. Vic Beasley dramatically improves. They signed Dwight Freeney. So I guess if there's any takeaway from Atlanta with respect to how they went about addressing the offensive line, do you think that is perhaps priority number one for the Giants in terms of going about improving this offense that you just alluded to?
Sure. Also, you know, telling your offensive linemen to never get hurt, because the Falcons are the only team in the league to start all five of the same offensive linemen
That's
in every game. And that, you know, continuity is, I mean, you can just directly correlate that to success. I mean, first of all, if you have five offensive lines who aren't very good, they're not going to start every game, and that continuity is just tremendous. Alex, I don't see them signing an Alex Mack type of guy, but I unquestionably see them adding to their offensive line either in the draft, certainly, or you know, with like a mid-level guy who can come in and certainly compete. They need to change their offensive tackle situation. They don't need to get rid of everybody they have there, but they cannot go in next year with Eric Flowers, with Bobby Hart, and with Marshall Newhouse, who is a free agent, as their, you know, top three offensive linemen. That just will not work, whether you want to move Eric Flowers to right tackle. And I think it's a little bit funny that, you know, we all say, and I'm guilty of it too, by saying, look, you got to move Eric Flowers to right tackle, as if right tackle is a position on the bench. You know what I mean? And as if you don't need to be a good player at right tackle.
Yeah.
Of course, that is not accurate, but I do think he's more suited to that position. So they need to, number one, I think, you know, their offensive tackles were ranked really, really low this year. They need to improve that talent base, number one. Number one, that's what they have to do.
Well, I want to kind of dig deeper a little bit on that, Paul, because as you well know, it's rare, you know, and there are exceptions to the rule. You saw it with the Titans' number one draft pick this year, who had a very good year at tackle, who the Giants were reportedly considering until the Titans went ahead of them to pick him. But a lot of times, even Jake Matthews with the Falcons is a rookie. He struggled as a rookie. Can you rely on the draft, especially when you're picking, you know, in the bottom third of the first round in a tackle that is not heavy in offensive tackles, to draft a tackle in the draft and expect them to come in next year and be significantly better than what they had? Or is this front office going to either have to use free agency or maybe get creative with the trade here to try to bring in a veteran to stabilize the situation and then maybe draft somebody on top of that that you would groom then moving forward for the future? What do you think the best plan of attack is?
Yes, I agree to all of that. The best plan of attack is to improve their talent. I think the Giants are in a position right now where they can add a older, experienced guy at tackle.
I agree.
You know, harken back to Lomas Brown many years ago. You know, I don't think that's – I mean, that's not the way they rebuilt their defense smartly. They realized, look, we're in this for the long haul. We'll sign guys in their mid-20s on the upswing. You know, that was perfect. But I think on the offensive line, let's face it, it's not like they have completely – ignored their offensive line. Weston Richburg is a second-round pick. Justin Pugh is a first-round pick. Eric Flowers is a first-round pick. These are all young guys. You can debate if those three high draft picks are operating on the level you need them to, but they certainly are guys that they're young guys that you need to be your cornerstones one way or another. So I think the Giants are in position right now. If they can find an offensive lineman who is a veteran, who can you say we can squeeze 1 or 2 years out of him if he's a leader, I think they could use a leader. They could use a guy who the offensive lineman can rally around. You know, Justin Pugh tries to do that, and he's okay at it. But I think he could use somebody also. You know, just like, you know, I think Victor Cruz was a good influence on Odell Beckham. You need to have a smart balance on your, which is a margarine, I believe, also, right? Smart balance, but you need to have a smart balance in the way your roster is configured. So, and also, yes, I think they can find someone at the 23rd pick or in the second round who will be a good player. I guarantee you, there will be players in this draft in the first, second, third, maybe even fourth round who will end up being good quality starters in the NFL. So, you know, you can find them. You know, they found David Deal in the fourth round. They found Chris Knee in the second round. You know, you can find them if you look hard enough and are smart enough.
You know, Paul, I got a question because it's weird. You wouldn't think there would be many divergent and extreme opinions about an offensive guard, but Lance and I have experienced on Twitter the polarizing opinions on John Jerry. There are some people that think he should be an all-pro, and then I got a group of fans that think he's the worst guard in football. I think he's a pretty good pass protector, maybe could improve in his run blocking a little bit. What's your take on Jerry? Do you think that he's somebody the Giants should look to retain, or are you looking to try to make a big upgrade at that guard position this offseason?
I think John Jerry is fine if he's your fifth offensive lineman.
Okay.
I think he can be number five. You know, you don't need a Pro Bowl array, 1 through 5 across the board. I agree with you. He's a better pass blocker than he's probably given credit for. He is despite his size, he's not a road grader kind of run blocker. There's no question about that. But I think the tackle is where you need to look first. You need to improve. You need to get, put it this way, you need to get your best offensive tackle. He is not on this roster yet. I'm sorry. Eric Flowers, if he develops into that in year three, God bless him. Just like in other, you know, I thought they needed to gain certain players. You needed to bring in your best, you know, run stopper, which they did. You know, there's certain times where you look at the team and you say, we need to augment, and there's certain times I think we need to bring the best one in. They need to bring their best offensive tackle. Now, it might be not from day one opening the season next year, but you need to bring in the best one because you need better players there. And however you do it, whether you sign a veteran, you know, for a year, that's fine. Whether you draft one, whether you make a smart trade for a guy and all of a sudden he develops, that's harder to do because you have to be smarter than everyone else, and that's hard to do. You know, it's just the way it needs to work. That's all there is to it. You know, the Packers had two good offensive tackles. You know, you need better players. Now the Falcons improved in an interesting way with their center, who was a tremendous center and kind of galvanized that whole line, and that was terrific. The Giants need to do it from the outside in.
Yeah, referring to the Green Bay Packers, David Bakhtiari and Brian Bulaga, two veteran tackles that they showcased. We're talking with Paul Schwartz, who covers the Giants for the New York Post. And, Paul, earlier you did allude to Eric Flowers, and there's a lot of chatter that he may be moved to the right side. Jerry Reese obviously brought that up during his end-of-the-season press conference. So did Ben McAdoo. One of the things, though, that I've noticed from a number of Giants offensive linemen is how they use other areas to improve their technique in the offseason. We saw that with Justin Pugh. We saw that with John Jerry. He's worked with Bentley, the former offensive lineman.
So is Richburg, too.
Correct. So a number of guys have gone that route, Paul. How important is it maybe for Eric Flowers this offseason, now that he's not dealing with the ankle injury, to maybe go down that road and look for alternative ways to improve technique other than what you basically do on the football field and in practice?
Well, you know, we've heard this, you know, hand placement technique issues with Flowers for 2 years. We heard it coming out of Miami, certainly. We heard it all his rookie year. We heard it more so this year. So whatever he has to do to get better. One of the problems is that there has been zero competition for Eric Flowers the last 2 years. Zero. He was handed a starting job. He has, you know, and as a rookie, he gutted out some ankle issues and showed a toughness, which was good. But there is no putting his feet to the fire at all with this team the last 2 years, and that has got to stop. You know, and you know, Jerry Reese mentioned that this is a big year for him, and that was good. But that has got to stop. That he is just guaranteed a starting spot coming back. So, it's not about him, you know, posting things on social media about how hard he's working, which he doesn't do. It's not about him, you know, if he wants to go to Charles Bentley's offensive line camp, that's tremendous. He just needs to do whatever he needs to do to sit down and look himself in the mirror and say, this is not good enough, and I could be out of the league in 2 years if I don't get better. I mean, that's the point the Giants are in with Eric Flowers. He needs to be the first one in, the last one out. You know, this is his second offensive line coach. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Pat Flaherty is a very respected coach, and, you know, I'm convinced that not the only reason, but one of the reasons that Pat Flaherty was not the offensive line coach last year is that Eric Flowers and Pat Flaherty were not exactly simpatico on some things. Now he has, you know, Solari, who is another respected veteran coach who did not get a lot out of Eric Flowers this year. You know, he doesn't get a third coach, in my opinion. So, you know, he's back on the team. You know, he's a first-round pick. That's fine. He needs to, you know, 2017 needs to be the make-or-break year for Eric Flowers. And however he has to do that, he has to do that. But, no more you're just grandfathered a starting job because of your first-round draft status.
All right, moving away from the offensive line real quick, Paul. Other issues with this offense, their inability to make as many big plays this year, and a lot of it has to do with their inability to get teams out of that or beat that two-safety deep package, whether it's, you know, a cover-two zone or a two-deep man coverage underneath. And one way you can beat that type of coverage is thrown to the tight end down the middle, down the seam. And the Giants have been trying to patchwork that position for a few years now. Are you to the point now where you think the Giants need to invest serious capital and value, whether in free agency or in the draft, in finding a better tight end than what they have on this roster right now? Or are you happy going to war next year with the guys they have and Will Johnson coming back from injury?
No, they cannot go with the three tight ends they have this year. There's no chance they can do that. Larry Donnell was basically, marginalized as the season went on, and I would be shocked if he's back. You know, maybe he'll compete for a roster spot. Will Tye is a good story, but he's an adequate player at best. Jarrell Adams is an interesting rookie, and I think he has potential, and I think he is, should come back as the number one tight end for a variety of reasons. But, and I think Jerry Reese would probably fight us on this. You know, Jerry Reese has shown that he feels you can get a tight end either low in the draft or as a free agent. Jeremy Shockey was not his call, years and years ago. If they draft a tight end in the first or second round this year, the Alabama kid is somebody who, everybody loves. That would be a departure for Jerry. And it would have to be that he is rated very, very highly on their board, because it's just not a position where he looks at, I don't think, and says, we need to get this guy early, as you would maybe a left tackle or a receiver or something like that. It's a way to go. I don't think you need a superstar at tight end. You need better players. You need someone who can stretch the field. You need someone who can block. I mean, years ago, you could always find a tight end who could block, hulking guy who could block, a Howard Cross, who was an excellent blocker, obviously, excellent, a second-rate receiver, but a top-rate blocker. They need a blocker. I mean, there's a reason why they didn't break a lot of runs to the outside, and it wasn't just because of their running back. So they need a blocking tight end first and foremost, I think. Whoever that is, you know, he's probably not on the roster now. And then they need someone who can stretch the field a little bit. Ideally, it's the same player, but maybe it's not the same player. You know, I don't think that's priority number one, but I do think they need to get better there. There's no doubt about it.
Well, Paul, it's interesting you brought up the need for a blocking tight end, and one of the names John threw out was Will Johnson, and I know, you know, everybody who covers the Giants had at least high hopes that, you know, he would be a key integral component to the offense, because if you look at how he was used in Pittsburgh, he was sort of a jack-of-all-trades, tight end, fullback, could even run with the football. The fact that at least the expectation is he will still be on the roster next season, I know you think maybe they still need to add more bodies, but what type of a role, if anything, do you think Will Johnson can have on this team and perhaps make some inroads in that running game?
Well, he was so vital to the team this year that when he went on IR, they just basically took the whole position and white-outed it. You know what I mean? I mean, so I don't know. I mean, that's – I mean, obviously it's a better question for Ben McAdoo. You know, Ben McAdoo comes from an offense in Green Bay that uses the fullback.
Yeah.
Right, you know, for years they used a big, burly, bruising,
Ripkowski.
You know, John Kuhn. Right, they used Kuhn. They used you know, Ripkowski. Now, you know, they use a fullback, and so he's come from a system that uses a fullback to run a little bit and to block a lot and to catch passes fairly often. Yes, so it was very easy for us to look at that and say, well, Will Johnson's going to be that guy. So, but I can't imagine that when Will Johnson got hurt, Ben McAdoo looked and said, there is nobody on the planet that can do this now, so we're just not going to carry a fullback on the roster. So I don't know what, you know, I would tend to think that McAdoo is more of a, you know, not from the Mike McCarthy mold to say, we need this guy as a fullback, or else he would have found someone to try to do that role. The
Good
fact
point.
That he did not do that makes me wonder, you know, I suppose Will Johnson will be back, and, you know, we'll see what he has to offer in training camp, but, you know, I think he thought he could get away with Shane Vereen as the pass catcher out of the backfield, not as a physical force as a fullback, but as a threat that way. That has not turned out to be the case because of injuries and other things. So, you know, they need to look at this offense and, you know, become more multiple, become more interesting, become a team that is not so reliant on their, you know, 5'11" superstar receiver to do everything for them.
Final question for me in the offense, Paul, drawn by Paul Schwartz in the New York Post, covers the Giants, does a great job. Paul Perkins, I was very impressed with what I saw from him the last couple of games. We've had some Giant fans call up in these couple weeks since the season's been over saying, oh, you got to use a first-round pick on a running back, you need a playmaker. In my opinion, I thought I saw enough from Paul Perkins to be fairly comfortable handing him the reins of the starting job to start next year. Curious to think of what you think about that and whether or not you think the Giants do need to add a significant piece at running back at some point this offseason.
Well, I would say I would agree with you and disagree with you. I would agree with you that Paul Perkins is one of the running backs on the team next year who can get a much larger role. I don't say you hand him the reins to the starting job because that's not what the league is now unless you're Ezekiel Elliott.
No, that's fair. That's a good point.
Or a facsimile of that.
That's a good point.
I mean, the Falcons, you know, look at the Patriots. They have a revolving door at running back. You know, they pick a guy, they have another guy. You know, I mean, you know, they have two guys. You know, and in the Super Bowl, it might be one of them, it might be the other one. We don't know. Look at the Falcons. You have Devonta Freeman and Tevin Coleman, and you know, I'm tempted to write Devonta Coleman and Tevin Freeman because I don't, you know, I'm trying to figure them apart and I'm watching them and they have distinct styles, but they are, when people talk about them, they talk about their stats together. So Perkins can be one of them. No, I think no question. Now, the second one I don't think is on the roster right now. That's where you need to upgrade. You don't need to bring in a first-round draft pick and say he's our star running back. You need to bring in a guy who has some speed, who can catch the ball. You need to bring in a guy who brings a dimension to the offense that they don't have right now.
Good point.
I don't think it's Rashad Jennings. I don't think it's Orleans Darkwa. I don't think it's Bobby Rainey. I think it's Paul Perkins and somebody else.
Well, Paul, speaking of perhaps added additions to the offense, when you look at the receiving core, you know, there's also youth with what Sterling Shepard did this season, maybe some question marks about Victor Cruz's future. But I think when everybody looks at this receiving core, they say, well, maybe the one thing missing is perhaps that big, tall wideout, that big target for Eli Manning, like a Plexico Burris, like a Hakeem Nicks. How fair do you think that is when you analyze this receiving core and whether or not that should be a priority as they hit free agency in the draft this coming offseason?
Well, you can also put that into the tight end. It doesn't have to be the receiver. You know what I mean? I mean, how many Giants receivers or tight ends were guys you threw the ball up to? You know what I mean? You know, Kevin Boss was a guy you could throw the ball up to. Martellus Bennett was a guy you could throw the ball up to. They didn't have a guy you could throw the ball up to. You know, Will Tye caught the ball in his midsection, 6 yards from the line of scrimmage. Odell Beckham gets up. He can jump. Sterling Shepard gets up. He can jump. So I think they need a offensive player who can do that. Now, look, you're not going to get – it would be great to get a big stud receiver – but I don't think you're going to get that in the draft where the Giants are drafting and what their priorities are. They have a superstar receiver, and they have in Sterling Shepard, a guy coming off a very promising rookie year. But so I think you need a big target who can stretch the field a little bit and go up and get the ball, whether it's another receiver or another tight end. That's what you need. I agree. When you look at the Giants receivers, you can look eye to eye with them, basically, right?
Yep,
you know, Cruz is 6 foot.
Well, not Lance.
I'm the exception to every rule, though, Paul. So.
Well, what about Bobby Rainey?
Yeah, Bobby Rainey's my type of guy. Absolutely. Bobby Rainey yes, fits okay. my criteria. There you
so,
go, Paul.
So
yeah.
Bobby Rainey is a guy you can look eye to eye with. But look, I'm not exactly, tipping the scales at 6 foot either here. So, but you know, they're the same. And like I said, they can jump, and they're you know good players. And Odell's a great player, but you need someone with more size. That's definitely something they need to target.
All right, Paul, I want to get to at least one or two defensive topics real quick. We'll hold you for just one or two more minutes here. Jerry Reese said in his postseason press conference that there is a way to retain both JPP and Jonathan Hankins. The Giants have money to work with this offseason, whatever the exact numbers, we'll see when the salary cap gets set. Here's my two-part question for you. What's the chances you think both guys are back? And if so, which one you think has a better chance of being back? And number two, if they're both back, do you see two long-term deals? Maybe one short-term, one long-term? How do you see that whole Hankins-JPP thing working out this offseason?
That was like a question with four parts.
Yeah, it was. I'm
like,
sorry.
You had one, and then you broke it into two. So I'll tackle the second part of
good
the
luck on
third
that.
One first. Okay, how's that?
That's fine.
I think it is remote that they both come back.
Okay,
really remote. I just think, I think they would like JPP one, and they would like Hankins two. I think it is interesting. I don't know what Jonathan Hankins' market is. I thought I knew what Linval Joseph's market was a few years ago, and the Vikings exceeded that. Okay, I don't think the free agent community is going to look at Jonathan Hankins like they did Linval Joseph, in my mind.
Okay.
I think they will look at him a notch down from that. As far as JPP, look, if he wants what Olivier Vernon received, he will not be back with the Giants. I mean, that's all there is to it. You cannot have $285 million defensive ends and a $45 million defensive tackle. It just doesn't work. JPP's already said he will not sign for a one-year deal. I think that would not help the Giants either. You know, they're not going to sign a guy for $16, $17 million on the cap for 1 year. I think JPP figures he did his one-year stint. This last month, JPP didn't play. Didn't help him. You know, it didn't help him. He was surging, and then it just ended. No fault of his own, he got hurt. But, you know, when people are going to assess him, they're going to say he's got a guy with a permanently damaged right hand with not the, you know, correct amount of fingers on it. He's had, you know, this abdominal surgery. He's had other things. He's had shoulder issues. You know, he's a good player, and he played great at times this year, but the numbers aren't there and the injuries are there. So, you know, if they can work a mid-level deal for JPP, I think it works. I just don't see how both coming back. I would say JPP will maybe get an offer he can't refuse, and then Hankins comes back. It's a tough situation. You know, this is when you start building a defense and you spend so much money last year. The only problem with this is, I would say, is that long-winded answer is that I don't think either replacement is on the roster. JPP's replacement is certainly not on the roster.
Great
I don't think
point.
It's Romeo or Quara, and I really don't think it's Owa Odigizawa, who has been a disappointment in his 2 years. And I don't think Hankins' replacement is on the roster either. So the Giants have to look at that and say, if we don't sign this guy, who do we sign to replace them or draft to replace them? Because you can't now take a step back on the defensive line after taking such a step forward.
Talking with Paul Schwartz, who covers the Giants for the New York Post. And, Paul, I'm glad you just alluded to depth, because that was my question with respect to the secondary. Now, they went out, they brought in Janoris Jenkins, had a great season. DRC had a standout season. But if there's anything maybe we saw out of the Packers game is when DRC goes down, what does the depth chart look like when you have to rely on others to fill the slot and so forth? When you look at what's behind the Apples, the Jenkins, the DRCs of the world, who are all under contract and ready to come back, at least we assume next season, how would you assess what the back end of the corner depth chart looks for the Giants? And in your mind, is that a need that maybe they need to address, given when DRC missed reps and missed games this season, the Giants wound up losing those contests?
Well, depth at cornerback is always a need. I mean, talk to the Packers, right? The Packers yeah. got hurt by injuries and hurt in the defensive backfield at safety, at cornerback, and they could not compete against the Falcons, a few days ago. Could not compete. Good luck trying to – and the Giants lost their, second-best cornerback in Dominic Rodgers-Cromartie early in the Packer game. But you're going against – Aaron Rodgers, it's not just because DRC got hurt. It's because you're going against the hottest quarterback on the planet. It's a problem. If they were going against Case Keenum, I think they could have patched it up and made it work. So depth at cornerback, Trevin Wade is free agent, I believe.
Yeah.
He's a guy you can re-sign. I think he is capable as a fourth cornerback. DRC makes a lot of money next year, $7 million, and his cap number is high. I don't conceive of a way that you can not bring him back, whether you have some kind of adjustment. I don't know how apt he is to make any kind of adjustment. I think he likes it here and wants to be back, and I think DRC liked the fact that he played fewer snaps. DRC is not the kind of guy who says, I never want to come off the field. He's a guy who says, I want to be on the field when I need to be on the field, when the team needs me. And if you want to cherry pick a few snaps in the second quarter and have me not on the field, it's fine with me.
Yep.
I think that's the way he feels. And what we saw with DRC this year is less was more, less was better. The depth, Nat Burhey at safety, what do we make of him? Another terribly injury-plagued year. Cody Sensabaugh. I think those are good issues to have, whether you're saying, what do we do for our fourth cornerback? As long as your top three are okay, I think it's okay. I think that's a down-the-road decision with these other ones more important.
Paul, final question before we say goodbye. You mentioned Dominic Rodgers-Cromartie in your last answer. Anybody else you think that's under contract currently that might not be back next year?
Well, why don't we just address the elephant in the room right now? Victor Cruz is under contract for next year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I am not going to be the one to write or go on the radio and say, they need to cut Victor Cruz and, save cap money and move on from him, because I like Victor Cruz.
Yeah,
me too. And professionalism be damned. Whether that's the right thing from a football point of view, whether he deserves to have a chance to stay on this roster for a reduced salary, that's a high level decision. And, look, we know Victor Cruz is not going to come back for the price tag that he is allotted. We know that. And he knows that. That's not breaking new ground. I think Victor Cruz could have a spot on this team. If he does not, then they need to bring a receiver into that receiver room who is older and wiser than Odell Beckham Jr., because Odell Beckham Jr. cannot walk into the receiver room with Roger Lewis and Sterling Shepard and Tavares King and I don't know if there's anyone else there and say, okay, this is our room, here we go. You need an older, wiser head in that receiver room, and whether it's Victor Cruz, fine. Whether it's not him, then you better have someone else in there, because Odell's a lot of things, but complete leader, I don't think at this point is not what he is. So I think Victor Cruz is certainly someone who fits that category. Dwayne Harris, he made the Pro Bowl, as a special teamer, but by the end of the year, the Giants were looking for other options, for him in the return game. So, Dwayne Harris takes a beating and keeps on ticking, but, I could see possibly them making a move with him. If you want to throw out some names, I'll talk about them. But, I think those are the marquee guys, I think, that could be in danger.
Paul, great stuff. We appreciate the time. We'll catch up to you down the road. We'll see you out at the Combine, and enjoy the Super Bowl.
Paul, thanks for the time.
Anytime. Thanks, guys. Take care.
That's Paul Schwartz. Great stuff out of him. We figured you've been hearing from us for 2 weeks. We should try to get you another point of view. And I think the point that I like the most out of Paul, and then we'll get to your calls you guys have been holding. We'll get to you right away, I promise. People talk about the big receiver. Why can't that big receiver be the tight end?
Absolutely.
I think
it certainly could be the tight end.
Great point.
It just depends on where you think you have the best opportunity to get that size.
Correct.
Is it the tight end through the draft or free agency, or is it the wide receiver through the draft or free agency? I mean, that's what I think it really comes down to. But I would agree. I mean, look at Jimmy Graham, Greg Olsen. There are teams that have the tight end essentially serve as the wide receiver, and they're a very big red zone target. So,
heck, Jared Cook and
the other
guy.
No disagreement there. Correct. Yeah.
Jordan Reed.
Plenty of tight ends that
Zach
serve
Ertz.
As big targets.
I mean, yeah. All in the division. Just look at the division.
And some of those guys are number two and number three in receptions or receiving yards on their respective teams.
Absolutely. 201-939-4513. Thank you for being patient, everybody. Phil in North Carolina will lead us off. Phil, how are you today, buddy?
I'm good, guys. How are you?
Hi, Phil. What's up?
Phil?
Yeah. One point I want to make is the tight end. You just fed into that. It's basically, I've been complaining about the tight end from Jerry Reese for quite some time, and letting Martellus Bennett go. I think it has to be a higher priority this offseason, and I think we have to allocate some resources. Second thing is, I think the confidence in the left tackle really hurt Eli this year, and I think his play went down after he got that hit in the Washington game.
Agreed.
So
Chris Baker.
So the offensive line was actually his confidence level in the line, regardless of where they actually played. The offensive line as a whole actually went down in play, or at least in the perspective of Eli's mind. And third, I hope we make the right choices because we have to increase this touchdown amount because we can't go on winning by 3 points. And I'll take your answers off the air. Thank you.
Hey, look, Phil, you got to score more touchdowns. I don't think anybody would debate that. They did improve their red zone offense from 2015 to 2016. It went up from like 45% to 53%, I think. So that got a lot better from one year to another, almost a 10% jump. But, yeah, look, you got to score more touchdowns. I mean, that's how you win in this league. You know, you go back to these playoff games, team that drive down and they get field goals and don't get touchdowns, it always ends up going back to bite them later in the game. So, look, I don't disagree with anything. He said, I think all his points are right on.
They scored 11 less offensive touchdowns this season compared to last season. 41 in 2015, 30 this year. I'm removing the defensive and special team scores. I'm just talking about the offense because you can't go into seasons thinking your defense and your special teams is going to get in the end zone. So, I mean, that lays out the point that the last caller mentioned. That's a difference of 11 touchdowns. We're not talking about three. We're not talking about five. We're talking about 11. I don't think anyone would disagree with the sentiment, the coaching staff included, that they've got to find the end zone more often, specifically the offense.
And by the way, I did a little research on the show I do with Eagles on Friday. I don't have it in front of me, but I believe almost all those touchdowns can be accounted for on drives of 60 yards or more. Last year, they had about 20 touchdowns in those situations. This the year before, 30. So they had 10 fewer touchdowns on drives of 60-plus yards from last year to this year, which I thought was interesting.
So, meaning even off the top of my head, I mean, look at how many big plays Odell Beckham made where it was just the flash of an eye and then he'd get in the end zone, as opposed to those long, sustainable drives where maybe you're getting to the 30 and you're getting to the 20 of the opposition and then you're punching it in.
Right.
And you can't rely on those home run plays all the time.
Yeah, and
you can't.
By the way, they had five or six fewer plays of 40 yards or more too, so that obviously will take that length of drive down. Even if you think about it, I mean, Beckham, just off the top of my head, both his touchdowns against the Ravens were for 60 or more
yards.
Huge
big plays. The
and
Cowboys
his touchdown
won.
Against the Cowboys
was
for 60 or
too.
More yards. So those are think those are their only 60-plus yard plays that went for scores this year. Maybe he had one other one, Beckham, if I'm not mistaken. I don't quite remember. But the bottom line is that they did not have as many long drives for scores this year, and a lot of that was the fewer big plays. 201-939-4513. By the way, they had a bunch fewer first downs this year than they had the year before, too. They went from, like, 7th in the league to 28th in the league in total number of first downs, which, again, you cannot sustain drives. That's when you run into problems.
And I could actually give you the specific numbers. They had 266.
Versus 331.
In 2015.
So if that's about that is about 65 first downs. Divide that by 16 games. You're looking at 4 fewer first downs per game. That could be one sustained drive that turns into a touchdown, and there all of a sudden – there's your 7-point per game difference in scores.
And now I'm going to bring it back to the postseason. We'll get to more of your phone calls here in a second. I'm going to use Atlanta as an example. What do the Falcons do great? Number one, they utilize their personnel probably better than anybody else in the NFL.
Targets more receivers than anybody.
I mean, 13 guys scored touchdowns that Matt Ryan threw to. But number two, how many drives have we seen in the postseason as well as the regular season? 9 plays, 80 yards, 13 plays, 85 yards, 8 plays, you know, 90-some-odd yards. They not only do they rely on the big play, but they'll also take what the defense gives them, and they'll just wear down the defense. And that's why time of possession is good for them, running game is good for them, and that equates to touchdowns. So that's a model that you certainly want to be able to look at it. Dallas, too, I think to a certain degree, was also in the early stages of the season, you know, fed very well into those categories.
Paul in Las Vegas, his point here is maybe a bit of a gamble, which I think is fitting given where he's calling from. What's going on, Paul?
Yes. How are you doing this morning, guys?
We're great, Paul. How are you?
All right. You know, Odell Beckham, he's in the third year of his rookie contract. So either after next year he's going to want to renegotiate or wait till, you know, the fifth year. So the next 2 years, it's not going to cost very much money. The reason I say it's not going to cost money is because what do you think a trade – you could get for Odell Beckham to help solve all these offensive programs? I mean, we can't keep going, you know, Manning to Beckham, Manning to Beckham. I mean, when they score a lot of points, which they did the year before, the other point I'm throwing in with this is McAdoo. The year before, he wasn't the head coach. He just took care of the offense. This year, and Carl Banks brought that up, that he's calling plays and he's head coach, that maybe if they change that, they, you know, they could get back to scoring more points, or, you know, who knows, maybe he needs this first year. But what do you think, really, this Odell Beckham? I mean, my God, he bangs his head against the wall, he punches holes in walls, he takes some of these penalties on the field.
Hey, look, Paul, here's the bottom line to me with Beckham. Would you like all that other stuff to be cleaned up and disappear? Absolutely, no argument. But
yes, but
allow me to say this, too. If you remove Odell Beckham Jr. from this offense, and again, you're talking about trading him, so this isn't the situation. But if you remove him from the offense, period, and don't add anybody, this offense probably scores 10 fewer points per game. I mean, you're looking at probably one of the worst offenses in the NFL. I think that's how important he is to this group. So, again,
there's no doubt that he's, you know, a tremendous talent.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And you know, no, we're not arguing that. But how many holes could you fill, you know, by trading him? What do you think he's worth?
Well,
that's
remember,
my question to you.
Paul,
do you think he's worth a great offensive lineman and maybe a great linebacker? Or is he? Can you make, you know, move up in the draft besides that?
Well, Paul, I'll say this. If you trade Odell Beckham Jr., you will not get a player back that's as good as Odell Beckham Jr.
I would agree with that.
You might get two lesser players, but you're not getting a player that's as good as Odell. He's a top 10 player in the league.
And nobody's giving up a franchise left tackle, because then they're going to have a hole to fill. You just don't see that happen very often.
I mean, the idea you would probably have, Paul, is that you would kind of do something similar to what we've seen, where you'll get a veteran player, that another team's trying to get rid of because he makes too much money, and then you probably get a couple draft picks, you know, number ones maybe in back-to-back years, something like that. And, yeah, maybe that'll help you down the road. But
it's not going to help you right now.
Yeah, Paul, to me, here's the thing. When you have a player like Beckham, there aren't that many true difference makers in this league. You can probably count them on two hands. How many guys can really take over a game and change the game at a blink of an eye? If you have one, you really need to do your best to keep your hands on them because they don't grow on trees. They're hard to find. What happens? Let's say you trade Beckham in your theoretical world, okay? Let's say you trade Beckham for a really good left tackle and you trade him for a linebacker, okay? Just like you said. What the heck are you doing a wide receiver next year?
You're going to have to rely on probably a rookie in the draft. And then also go back to last season, Paul. You know, you brought up, you know, the difference in the offensive production. What about the game that Beckham missed against the Minnesota Vikings? What happened when he wasn't on the field?
Yeah. And by the way, if Beckham's not there, yeah, it's great. So you have better pass protection for Eli Manning. Who the hell is getting open for him to throw the ball to when he gets that pass protection?
I mean, he made so many big plays to, you know, help them win close games. If you remove him from the equation, you better have somebody that is going to be just as explosive that can replace him. I mean, Atlanta's got Julio Jones, so they're not too quick to get rid of him.
No.
And I know New England doesn't necessarily have one particular wide receiver, but they've got a lot of balance and a lot of versatility on their roster. You can't...
Well, that's what I would say, you know, to try and get, you know, more balance because, like you said, the Patriots don't have that. But you guys seem to feel that Beckham, you can't, you know, he's a great player and that, but you can't get enough to offset his loss. So,
no.
Like Jerry Reese mentioned in his postseason deal that, you know, he had talked to Beckham because – it's going to come to a point if he can't, you know, get a hold of himself mentally that, you know, you're going to have this decision when it comes 2 years from now. So maybe it's worth trying to cultivate him for 2 years. You know, I've competed all my life. I've seen a lot of people, you know, compete and different personalities and everything. And to me, Odell, a lot of players in football are in this position where – They're really would be better off in a one-on-one sport, like maybe golf or tennis or pool or something that's one-on-one because they, you know, their ego or whatever takes so much upon themselves that they want the whole thing, you know, they feel that they can do it all.
Yeah, but Paul,
so,
you know what? I will say this.
A lot of people are in that position, you know, that play team sports.
No, I hear you, but I will say this, and I believe this deep down. I think this is the truth. To me, now, he can maybe reduce the, you know, emphasis on other things, but to me, bottom line still, the most important thing to Odell Beckham Jr. to me is still winning. And I think he gets more happiness out of team success than he does out of individual success. We've seen him after games. He's always happier when the team wins than when they lose, obviously, no matter how well he plays. And he's never more upset than when the team loses, no matter what his numbers are. So, to me, when you have a guy that really does care about winning or losing above all else, you can work on the other stuff. Remember, he's just 23 years old.
Still a very young guy.
He's a guy that you can figure this other stuff out on.
I agree, you know. And listen, I'm on the outside.
Right.
I'm rooting for this guy as much as, you know, anybody on the outside. Listen, I've been a Giant fan since 1945, you know. So I know that, you know, he could be, you know, more of an asset than he is now. I mean, and we all see that. So, you know, I'm just hoping, you know, hope for that.
Thank you, Paul.
I was just wondering what you thought, you know, he was worth on a trade.
Appreciate it, my friend. Okay. Thanks for the call.
You got it, Paul. Everybody obviously deals with emotion differently. So, I mean, everybody's not cut from the same cloth. I think people need to understand that. That's number one.
And people do change, I think, too, is important.
They mature over time. Correct. They learn. They look at how the media portrays them and whether or not they're content with that. But, you know, Paul alluded to this, and I don't want to make a big deal of it, but, you know, he threw out the word penalty. And I think the word penalty and Odell Beckham has become very synonymous with one another. But just out of curiosity, and I don't know if you saw my screen, how many penalties do you think Odell Beckham picked up this season?
This season?
In total. And I'm going to throw it out to the fan base, too, to chime in on Twitter.
I'm going to say two.
So you think he only picked up two penalties over the course of the entire season? And I'm talking about 16 games here. And I'm talking about all types of penalties, too, by the way. I'm not just talking about
I don't think he had
unsportsmanlike conduct
or whatever.
I don't
think he had an offensive holding on a run play. I don't remember an offensive pass interference. You know, I'm going to say three. I'm going to go three total over the course of the whole year. Because I think he maybe had one offensive pass interference call on him, or maybe a false start or something like that. So I'm going to go three.
You're close. You're close. I have the list of all of his penalties. He had five penalties over the course of the season.
What were the five?
The five penalties for Odell Beckham, as I look through here. He had a pass interference call.
He did have one offensive pass interference call.
He had two pass interference calls.
I think one of those might have been on a pick play, actually, if I remember right.
Correct, it was, at the end of the Redskins
game. Yes, okay, I remember that now. Okay.
And then he had two personal fouls this season.
Okay, see, just I thought he had two personal fouls, and then he had the one pass interference. That's what I thought he had. So, well, and what was the fifth one, like a false start or something like that?
The fifth one, let's see here. Fifth one, I think, was a holding or a false start. If I could, false start.
Okay.
That was the fifth one.
Yeah.
So, two pass interference, a false start, and then the two personal fouls.
Right.
So, five penalties over 16 games, two personal fouls, and both of those personal fouls were early in the season.
Correct.
We're talking about the Vikings game, you know, nothing pretty much beyond week seven. So, the reason I bring that up is the narrative seems to be for Odell Beckham, player that's completely out of control, distraction to the team, taking away from the team. But then I think when you look at the numbers, you see a guy that picked up five penalties, no personal fouls since early in the season. And I wanted to just bring that up just to look at this is how the media and everybody else perceives him, but this is reality when it comes to the facts.
And by the way, his teammates do really like him, too. He's a well-liked guy. This isn't Terrell Owens rolling through the locker room, you know, splitting half the team against the other half and creating factions in the locker room here, okay? He's well-liked in that locker room. He really, really is. So I know that's gone around Twitter. I think it's to consider trading him is bat crazy.
Well, and the other thing is, how many times do you see star players traded for star players?
You
see star players traded for draft picks. You see that happen a lot.
Look at what the Eagles got back for LeSean McCoy. Kiko Alonso's an all right player, but he's not.
He's not even on the roster anymore.
He's not. He ain't LeSean McCoy.
Yeah.
He ain't.
You know, it's all about maximizing value in the National Football League, and I think there's a number of players that you could go in hoping you maximize value. It's just not realistic. And I don't think for a guy like this you're truly ever going to get the equivalent in return. You could certainly stockpile draft picks, but remember, draft picks is all about what you do with them. You don't know what you're going to get out of them. It's still a mystery.
I mean, the odds you get somebody, even if you get two first-round picks, what's the odds you get one of those picks turns into a player that's as good as Odell Beckham Jr.? You get, what, one every Odell Beckham Jr. every couple of drafts? Not even every draft. So, I mean,
it's crazy.
Let's go to Shrias in Massachusetts on line number one. What's going on, Shrias? How are you, buddy?
Hi, John, and Lance.
Hi, Shreyas. How are you?
How you doing?
So, I'm good. So, I've been a Giants fan a long time, pretty much my whole lifetime. But what I wanted to say was, in regards to like everything I've heard in this this session, I don't know, in this podcast, like everybody's been saying how our offense has been out of rhythm. Perhaps the players aren't the main reason why. Perhaps maybe. Maybe the coaches need some help. Maybe, like, I know, like, Ben McAdoo's the offense. It was his first year, first of all, so there's going to be some struggles. And I know Ben McAdoo is a play caller, but, like, he's the one who calls the plays. He doesn't make them. Like,
correct.
You got it. Like, I'm going to give you a metaphor. I mean, like, it's a metaphor. Like, so imagine Ben McAdoo is, like, someone ordering a food at a store. So he has this menu, and he's ordering food from it. But if the menu only has spam in it, then it's not going to be good.
Hey, look, and I think Travis, your point was shown well in the playoffs when the plays Ben McAdoo called put the wide receivers in position to make plays, but they couldn't hold on to the football. That's just one example out of 17 games this year, obviously. But look, I don't think you can put all the blame on any one facet of the team. I think, you know,
I'm not putting the blame on anyone. I think I said it wrong, but like maybe McAdoo's quote-unquote play calling is not the reason why. Maybe it's the plays themselves. Maybe Mike Sullivan needs some help. I know he's a very intelligent guy, and like in the interviews, you always see him being like coming off as very intelligent. Maybe he needs some help. Maybe like you know co offensive coordinator, like they have down in Kansas City.
Well, but Andy Reid is still the main play caller during the course of the game, though. When you look at the breakdown, I mean, Mike McCarthy, you know, he's somebody that handles both, too. Throughout his career, he's given up play calling responsibilities. He recently took it back. I mean, I think there's many different examples.
Yeah, but I'm talking about play designing.
You're talking about the structure of the play, and I completely understand where you're going. And listen, every offseason, and the process has already started now, you do a self-scout. Every team does this. The Giants are not unique, and you look at everything over the course of the 16 games in the playoff game, and you start to be critical and say to yourself, you know, where can you improve? Where can we move personnel around? What do we need to improve the team? I mean, the Giants do that every single season. They do it during the course of the year. I don't think this offseason is going to be any different with respect to that.
Exactly. You're right. It isn't only one thing. You're absolutely right. It's going to be multiple things put together. I'm sorry, we're already past 1 o'clock, Shreyas. Give us a call back another time. We got to run, okay? Appreciate the call, pal. Final call, real quick. AJ in South Carolina. AJ, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call. I know why we go is free agent. The Giants are bringing back.
Hey, look, the Giants have a number of free agents this year, AJ, and we appreciate the call. Thanks a lot that they're going to have to try to re-sign. Obviously, finances come into situations there, Lance. They'll do their best to bring back the guys they want to bring back. However those negotiations go, we'll have to wait and see. But it's always a busy time of year with the free agency, man. You know, last year the Giants turned free agency period into a huge reason. They rebounded and made
splash.
The playoffs, absolutely. I don't think we're going to see quite the amount of noise this year. I think it's impossible to have, you know, that type of splash 2 years in a row just based on how the salary cap works and all that stuff. But, look, I expect the Giants to be active in free agency again, whether it's retaining their own guys or bringing in new people from the outside.
Yeah, they're always going to keep their options open. I think, though, probably the narrative this offseason, more so than last offseason, is probably going to be whether or not they retain their own.
Yeah.
Just because they have two in particular that are half of their explosive defensive line being Hankins and JPP. So that's probably going to be the biggest storyline. Then after that, depending on what happens with those two players, then I could see perhaps the Giants exploring other options because, listen, whether you bring them back or not, that changes how much money you have to toy with.
Yeah,
so that's going to indicate a lot.
A unit, by the way, that was the strength of their roster. So do you really want to risk losing one or two pieces from that unit?
Of course.
It's something the Giants will have to weigh cost with production and figure out what works best for the team. Everybody, thanks for joining us. Thank you to Paul Schwartz for joining us as well. For that guy, Lance Menno, I'm John Schmelk. Tomorrow, we're back with more Big Blue Kickoff at noon. We'll see you then. Have a good one, everybody.
Have a good one.